The Money Show.
Business books.
Well, this week's business book is one of the most entertaining I've read in recent times. Rogues Gallery, an irreverent history of corruption in South Africa, from the VOC to the ANC, written by Matthew Blackman and Nick Dowell. And Nick Dowell is with us this evening. Where do we start this discussion? It covers 350 years. What did you set out to achieve, Nick?
Evening, Bruce, and thanks for having me. Matthew and I wrote the book. We were sick and tired of hearing people at briars and birthday parties and what have you saying things like, if they tried it in any other era, they would have ended up in prison. Zuma would have been in jail a decade ago, that kind of thing. So we kind of knew enough to know that that wasn't true. So we thought, let's put together a couple of chapters. And then, the more we dug, the more we found. And it went all the way back to the beginning.
Back to the beginning. The beginning you choose is the documented beginning, and that is 1652, the arrival of Jan van Riebeeck at the Cape of Good Hope. And no sooner do the settlers arrive in South Africa than we start seeing the theft of cattle from indigenous people. We start seeing people behaving like people do when there is no visible law and order, when they think they can make the rules up themselves.
Exactly. I mean, I think the reason we chose to start there was, firstly, we need a documentation to write the book. And secondly, you can't have corruption as we know it until you have a sort of economy as we know it. So our first character, although Jan van Riebeeck gets a very special mention, the first real rogue in the book is Willem Adrian van der Stel, who is about 50 years later, 1699. Now, his dad was... It's also a little bit on the corrupt side, Simon, but Willem just took it to the next level.
It's one of my favorite stories of corruption in South Africa, and I would love you to sketch it as broadly as you can. And it goes back to the founding of Vergelegen. It is the parallels with Nkandla, which used to be a big scandal, are absolutely legendary. It's about jailing your opponents. It's about stifling criticism. It's about shutting down your opponents. And it's ultimately about a recall. It's a fabulous tale.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't make it up. So basically, old Willem Adrian, who was the governor of the Cape outpost at the time, first thing he did was he got his boss in Amsterdam to give him the land where Vergelegen is, but it's much bigger than what Vergelegen is today, because it was... So it's like Vergelegen, Lawrenceford, Morgenster, the town of Somerset West, and much of the mountains into the Hottentot Holland.
Sure.
Then he used company materials, slaves, seed, livestock, whatever, to build this enormous palatial estate, by far the biggest farm in the Cape. And it was just producing endless amounts of wine, grain, cattle, whatever. And this despite the rules of the company forbidding him from owning anything more than a personal garden.
Because at the time, I mean, the employees of the company weren't allowed to compete with the free burghers, people who had come to South Africa and had gone out on their own and were making economic choices each and every single day. They'd gone as far as Groot Constantia, they'd gone as far as what is now the Boerland above the Hottentot Holland Mountains, and these guys were doing proper agriculture and taking proper risk, whereas Willem Adrian van der Stel was doing nothing of the kind. He was using all of the resources at his disposal illegally, and people like Adam Tuss, after whom the delightful Tussenberg is named, and there's an Adam Tuss road that goes out of Stellenbosch and towards French Hook. He's remembered as something of a folk hero in some respects, because he was a bit like Thuli Madonsela in some respects in terms of dobbing in Willem Adrian van der Stel to his bosses in the Netherlands.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, the only difference between him and Thuli is that Adam did have something to gain personally from dobbing in Willem Adrian, because he was a direct competitor. So the really great thing about Willem Adrian's scheme, and what actually makes it put Nkandla completely to shade, is that he had this huge bountiful farm, and then he sold all the produce back to the company at prices that he determined. So, I mean, it's the absolute perfect loop. You know, Nkandla didn't make a cent for Zuma, but this was an absolute mint for Willem Adrian, and it was a lovely place to hang out.
Let's not give away the entire tale, because, I mean, it's a wonderful story, and it goes into the very issue of colonial corruption. And then you talk about people like Lord Charles Somerset, and you talk about Rhodes, and you talk about Paul Kruger. I'm most interested in Paul Kruger's relationship with a guy who still causes traffic jams to this day. If you listen to 702's traffic reports, there's always some kind of disaster at Nelmapius. And if you're going to name an intersection or a road after one of Paul Kruger's besties, well, then you must expect to have trouble on the roads. Nelmapius was a nasty little sod as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. I mean, I have to admit to having a bit of a soft spot for him, because he was just such a chancer. He was a Hungarian Jewish guy who washed up in South Africa. I'm not really sure how. And in 1881, just after the Boer Republic had got its independence from Britain for a second time. So the Boers were liberated, but absolutely bankrupt and destitute. You know, they just had this patch of the Highveld and nothing, not much else. Nelmapius wrote to Kruger, who was a teetotaler, Kruger, and asked for permission to build the first liquor distillery in the ZAR. And Kruger was quite happy to give him this to him on condition that Nelmapius paid him, I think it was £1,000 a year, to have the exclusive right to manufacture booze in the ZAR. And yeah, this, I mean, Nelmapius was corrupt. He was quite a chancer. He was also quite a nice guy. One of his business associates, Sammy Mark, said he would always pay someone £3 for something that was worth £2.
It's very Gupta-like, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it is. So the problem came in, you know, this little liquor distillery in the small backwater in the middle of nowhere, you know, it was corrupt, but it wasn't going to change anyone's life, you know, either way. The problem came in when gold was discovered, 1886. And then just suddenly, you know, the whole world descended on the Witwatersrand to make a killing. And Kruger, and this is where the problem came in, stuck to this monopoly system that Nelmapius had introduced for the liquor distillery when granting concessions to manufacture dynamite, to construct railways, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, when you consider that they were using, I think it was 6 million cases of dynamite a year, when this is a, you know, a corrupt deal, the losses are incredible.
Yeah, and that's the problem, I suppose. But, I mean, did Kruger benefit personally from all of these monopolies? Did Kruger, I mean, we've heard of the Kruger Millions, but those I don't think were his personal wealth. This was supposedly the wealth of the Boer Republic. Did Kruger have a cash stash somewhere that came about as a direct result? Because he was a very religious man. He was a dopper, which is a weird name for a guy who doesn't drink, because he was anti-doping. Yeah. But did he benefit personally? Is there any evidence to suggest that he took bribes?
So I don't think he didn't not benefit. He definitely had more farms than he was allowed to own. He was allowed to own two, and he had over a dozen. He got a lot of presents from his friends. His house was given to him by Nelmapius. The big fancy lions outside the house were given to him by Barney Bonato. Sammy Marks paid for the statue that's still standing in Church Square. And his business friends helped him to sell a lot of his farms at a big profit to the mines. But he didn't make the kind of money that, I mean, much like Zuma, I mean, has Zuma made a killing out of his role in it all? I'm not sure. But some of Kruger's family members did. There was a guy, Fricky Elof, who was his son-in-law. Elof Street's named after him, I think. Definitely someone in his family. He made a lot. There were contracts on the water. There was this one railway scandal where 21 of the 25 members of parliament were found to have accepted bribes. And this was, the things they were given were also quite funny. So it was gold watches, wagons, fast wagons, slow wagons, paintings, that kind of thing. So it was an extremely corrupt system, but I don't think Kruger definitely wasn't the richest rogue in the book.
I am grateful to you for summarizing the Eshel Rudy information scandal. I absolutely relished the chapter, and I'm going to reread it once again because it's sort of in the mists of time have fogged over, involving Louis Leighton, of course, the Department of Information, the information scandal at the time. And Eshel Rudy, of course, was a brilliant but deeply problematic individual. And then I just wonder if we can summarize and just say, you know, every generation, I think, treats its problems as if they're unique. Every generation treats its problems as if they are something that's never happened before. And that's the purpose of your book, to say, hold on a second, guys, stop feeling sorry for yourself. Stop, you know, again, there's a issue of deep racism involved in much of the corruption discussion in South Africa as well. But I'm wondering whether or not the scale of what we've seen in the last 10 to 15 years is not what has made the scandal that we're living through right now industrial in its nature. If you've been able to compute relative to the likes of Rhodes and Diedrichs and Menon Maypius and Somerset and Willem Alder and Van der Stel, whether actually in real terms what we're going through now is unprecedented.
Yeah, I mean, so this wasn't really the aim of the book, but obviously it did cross our minds quite often, and we have been asked about it a lot. So, I mean, there's some guys who definitely don't really come that close to Zuma, because what Zuma presided over was pretty full scale. Like, it was state captured. It seeped into every
orifice. Crevice. Yes.
exactly. So, I mean, and the guys in the early days did the same kind of thing, but they had a much smaller pond to contaminate. You know, people like Somerset or Van der Stel. I think Rhodes is definitely up there.
Yeah.
You know, you can't, you know, him and Zuma, like, it, you know.
I don't know. In many respects, Rhodes was worse in many respects from the point of view that he raised an army and he then annexed what became Rhodesia.
Thousands of innocent people.
And, you know, in cahoots with Milner and others, fomented a bloody three-year war whose consequences we still live with today, you know, between 1899 and 1902. So, you know, yeah, Rhodes was a nasty sod. I went to the Rhodes cottage in Muesenberg many years ago.
I know where it is.
And I dared to suggest that he was a nasty sod, and I was chucked out. This was, you know, about 15 or 20 years ago, before the Rhodes Must Fall movement. And it was like, you know, how anybody can defend Rhodes' legacy. He's an interesting guy, and I think we need to study him and we need to learn from him. We need to understand his mindset, because he was, out of all of the rogues, I mean, rogue is too good a word, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think they said that he poisoned the land. I think that was one of his contemporaries. Yeah, I mean, there's still guys who support Rhodes. I mean, when his bust at Rhodes Memorial was decapitated the most recent time, there's an organization that funded to have it rebuilt, and there were smiling pictures of these guys on Facebook having sort of polished up his bust and cleaned up the plinth and all of that, and they were very happy to have their hero back on his pedestal. So, yeah, I mean, that's history for you.
It is. Nick, it's a fabulous piece of work. It really is. If it didn't matter so much, it would be hilarious. But it does matter. And that's the point, I think, that you make, is that, you know what, let's not kid ourselves that this is a new national sport. It's been a national sport for 3.5 centuries. And there are many people who have come before who have caused, you know, proportionately as much, if not more in some cases, bother than the Zuma administration ever did. So, you know, let's not forgive the Zuma administration, not for a moment. Let's hold the crooks to account in a way perhaps their predecessors were not properly held to account. But let's also keep some perspective on it to say that, you know, in an environment where the law is perverted, then, yeah, bad people take advantage. And I think that's, to my mind, the core message of the book.
We weren't for a moment trying to apologize for Zuma. And I think another thing that made us quite happy while researching the book was that we discovered that in every era, there have been good, upstanding people who've stood up to these rogues, and often at great personal risk. You know, in every single chapter, there was at least one whistleblower. And interestingly, quite a few of them were female, although none of the rogues were female.
Yeah, I'm like going to finish on that point. I mean, are women in South Africa not corrupt, or just not caught, or just too clever, or just not that greedy? I wonder. But yeah,
I think it's just about historical power balances. I mean, there just weren't any women leaders. So Stella Sikal was the first prime minister of any territory in South Africa, if you can call Transkei that. And she only lasted a few months because she was accused of bribery. And as you know, that saga continued on after 94 when Bantu Halimisa got fired for bringing it up again once she was a minister in Mandela's government. But I mean, the proof's there. She does seem to have been accepted 50 grand from George Matanzima via Saul Kersner. I mean, the affidavits from Kersner stating this. So. Yeah, I think once we have a female president, then we'll probably see some female corruption.
But Nick, thank you for doing it. Rogues Gallery, fabulous, irreverent history of corruption in South Africa from the VOC to the ANC. Next time you're at a braai, empower yourself to have the conversation with people who bemoan corruption as a 21st century invention. It's not. It's been here for an awfully long time. And in some respects, the corruptors of this century have built on the expertise that was created many, many years before them. Corruption's not a new thing, and it's not going to go away anytime soon either. That doesn't mean we should forgive it.